I think this time I'll do a podcast.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
What's up, everybody? Welcome in. It is episode 4 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. It is presented by our good friends over at Clip It. It's the number one way to share your favorite video, movie, and sports clips with your friends. You can download the clip today. Download the Clip It app today, I should say, on iOS and on Android. Coming up in a little bit, we will hear from Rory Brown, the president of Bleacher Report, with the president of Awful Announcing, Ben Koo. That is coming up in just a little bit. We'll also give you an opportunity to win $50 to Amazon.com. All you got to know is just be able to identify two of the clips from Clip It in our little game that we like to play each week. You identify both of them, you win $50. It's a very simple process. What's also a simple process is when we have our roundtable, and today I'm joined by Joe Lucia, as well as Andrew Buckholt. It's good to have you guys here. We're taping this on a Tuesday evening, just as the World Series Game 6 is about to kick off. So I think it's a perfect place to start, because this World Series has been unlike anything that I've ever seen. And I'm coming from a place where I thought last year's World Series was nuts, with the Cubs winning for the first time in 108 years. And that was spectacular for me. The year before, you had the Royals breaking a 30-year curse. It wasn't necessarily a compelling World Series, but I can't remember anything like this, where you have just home run ball after home run ball and intense, compelling theater. And game one, which goes about 2.5 hours, to game five, which was more than 5 hours. Joe, I'll start with you. Looking at this World Series overall, what have you made of everything?
I mean, it's just been so fun. The games haven't really been blowouts. They've all been really close, tight games. All the players that we thought would kind of stand out so far in this series have really stood out. We've seen guys like Carlos Correa, George Springer, Cody Bellinger, Jose Altuve all have their big moments. I think everything has really gone right for Major League Baseball, when maybe we really didn't expect some of these players to kind of show up and become such household names so early on in their careers.
I think what you said is valid as well, Ben, that it really has had something for everyone in a lot of ways. So you had that game one where it was just real quick, one of the fastest games you'll ever see in the baseball postseason. You had the game five that went on forever but didn't really feel like it, because it was such a roller coaster and such an up and down moment. And there's been a ton of home runs, but there have also been great pitching performances at times. There have been spectacular plays in the field. I've really enjoyed watching Alex Bregman and some of the stuff he's doing at third base. And I think it's been a lot of fun to watch, and it's been great for Fox. The ratings they've been getting are just very impressive for something that's not the Chicago Cubs.
I was very curious about how this World Series would draw from the very beginning, and I knew that it would be compelling. You had the best team in the National League, the best team in the American League. But after, you're right, Andrew, coming off a Cubs World Series, that sort of thing is very difficult to be able to back up the following year, factoring into the Cubs and the Indians went 7 games. We might have a chance of it again this year. I'm just curious to know sort of when you think the public began to start backing this World Series. And what I mean by that is I think there was good ratings for game one. And then I think game two was probably what catapulted this, right? That all of a sudden more and more conversation began coming out of this World Series. And naturally, as consumers, as sports fans, more and more people started to come in. Do you think it was right from the very beginning, Joe? Or do you think it was maybe after that crazy game two that everyone was like, man, I gotta be a part of something like this?
Yeah, I think game two kind of was the thing that pushed it over, because the game one ratings, like you said, they were strong. They weren't exceptional, but they were strong, and they kind of remained solid throughout the rest of the series. Like, there's usually a dip after game one, and then it slowly starts creeping up. There wasn't really much of a dip after game one, and then following game 3, 4, 5 in Houston, just kept going up and up, and we're looking at what's probably going to be, aside from last year, the second most viewed series since 2010, I believe, that Yankees-Phillies series in 2009 did really well. And, of course, last year's series between the Cubs and Indians was a strong one. But we haven't really had a series like this in nearly a decade, minus that one from last year, which is kind of an outlier because of the Cubs.
Andrew, are you surprised at all that this series has sort of taken on a new life, especially with ratings and with consumers, the way that it's gone?
Yeah, I think what's really impressive from the rating standpoint is I think that the Houston fans have shown up. Houston always looked like a good market just by sheer market size, and which is something that not everyone necessarily notices. But this is a very good World Series from a market size perspective. You've got a massive market in LA and a very big city in Houston. But there were questions about how much that would really be there for the Astros, just given that their local TV ratings are pretty middling. So I think the excitement of Game 2 certainly helped pull people in. I think they have really caught on to the public mind in Houston in a way that's not just diehard Astros fans watching. I think it is a lot of the city, it is a lot of the state, and I think that the excitement of the series has really helped to pull in neutral fans, because it's just been so crazy in a couple of these games that it's dominating the conversation on Twitter, it's dominating the conversation on sports sites, on radio shows, and that definitely helps as well.
That's another fascinating component to me as well, is because I thought Fox's strategy when this World Series matchup was announced is obviously you didn't have to do a whole lot with the Dodgers. But with the Astros, I thought it was going to be narrative city. I thought it was going to be, this is a city that has gone through so much and has suffered such a great amount, and it would have been a fair narrative to present. Man, it's so nice. And maybe this is just the baseball dork in me, who also consumes a lot of media. But it is so nice for them just to be able to market really fun, really exciting, a different style of baseball that we've seen from the past. It's not necessarily about the cities. It's about, you have two really damn good teams, and it's a fascinating back and forth contrast between the two of them.
Yeah, I mean, you have two really good teams, and it's not just that. It's the fact that they're both really young teams as well. I mean, you have young stars like Corey Seager, Jose Altuve, even though he's not that young in comparison to the rest of them, Bregman, Springer, Correa. They're all younger guys. And you have the household stars like Clayton Kershaw, Justin Verlander. Every baseball fan knows who those guys are. So you have this nice combination of kind of the established players plus the younger future stars. And you can build the game around. And I think Fox has done a really good job of kind of balancing those two types of players and teams they've had this year.
And you know, one other thing that I've noticed too is that maybe it's just been the compelling nature of a really good World Series. I haven't heard a whole lot of everybody hates Joe Buck, Joe Buck sucks, what's he doing, he loves the Dodgers, he loves the Astros, and maybe I haven't tapped in, Andrew, into the local fan bases, but I think people have just picked up these games and have just enjoyed them for what they've been. There's been less really to complain about, unless you're a hardcore fan of one of these teams. I think from a national perspective, people just said, this broadcast team is fun, these games are good. There's just not a whole lot to complain about right now.
Yeah, I think the broadcast has been generally good. I think that Joe Buck and John Smoltz have done a pretty good job. I think there hasn't been too much that's really ticked off one side or the other. The one thing that does bug me about them, and Buck did it quite a bit in Game 5 in particular, is on one hand, all of a sudden he's praising stats, and then the next minute he's criticizing stats. And I think they do tend to be a little too laudatory of whatever decision the managers make because the managers are making it. But then those are pretty minor criticisms compared to some of what we've seen in the past. And I think that the narrative of Joe Buck improving is continuing. I think he's come a long way from where he was calling some of these games a long time ago. And I think not everyone's going to love him, but I think the venomance of the hate has dialed down a fair bit.
Do you agree, Joe?
Yeah, I do agree. I mean, a lot of the negativity towards Joe Buck, I think it's kind of, I think a lot of people are just kind of over it. It's kind of a tired talking point that's been around for years. And I think it's kind of jumped the shark almost. It's so easy to just say, oh, Joe Buck is terrible and so on and so forth. But there's so many more announcers out there that are really bad. Joe Buck, that I'm not going to say that it's not fair to pick on Joe Buck, but I mean, he's been such an easy target for so long that I think it's easier for the hate to kind of go in a different direction.
What have you guys made of the overall broadcast so far with Buck, with Smoltz, Rosenthal, and Verducci? And I guess if you were putting together your ultimate baseball broadcast team for this type of event, for the World Series, who would be different? Would Smoltz still be in there? Would you take all of them out? And Andrew, I'll start with you on this. I guess if you were building your ultimate baseball broadcast World Series team, who do you think would be in it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and I'm not sure I really have a great answer to it. I think the one they have here is certainly fine. I think it helps that it is the two-man booth now. I always liked Tom Verducci, but I think having a three-man booth just feels too crowded for a lot of this.
I'm with you.
And everybody's rushing to get their points in there. And so I think it's useful to have two guys like Buck and Smoltz who have both done this for a long while, who have chemistry together and who are willing to let the game breathe a bit here and there and not necessarily talk over each other all the time. I don't think you can improve the reporters any more than with Rosenthal and Verducci. I think those are ideal guys to have as your sideline guys for this broadcast. And I appreciate having two of them, even though it may feel a little bit like overkill, but I think it's really useful for those post game moments where they can both go and grab a different player. And you have a couple of great interviews back to back rather than trying to have one guy run around and find everybody and keep throwing to him and back from him. So, I'm not sure it's necessarily ideal, but I think it's pretty close. And I don't know if there's any way that I'd be able to improve on it.
Who would you add in, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I generally agree with pretty much everything Andrew has said there. I mean, it's really tough to get a like ideal broadcast team based on what you're trying to go for. But I think having two experienced dugout reporters, one with each team, and then just a two-man booth, I think that kind of eliminates a lot of the chaos and limits the traffic. And it just creates the best overall telecast, I guess you could say.
I'm with you guys as far as the two-man booth goes. And on the sideline, I have no problem with Kenny and Tom. I think both of them are outstanding writers and very good reporters that I think, especially going to them, you know you're going to get quality information, then you're never going to have an issue with any of the questions that are asked. I've always been a big Dan Shulman fan, but I almost kind of like it the way that it is now, where he's on the radio. I don't know how much longer he'll be on the radio for ESPN. I think this is his last year doing ESPN games in general, but I mean, he's just an absolute joy to listen to on the radio. Him and Aaron Boone have been outstanding. The three-man booth was one of the few times I thought it worked with Shulman and Jessica Mendoza and Aaron Boone on the Sunday night game, which I thought was a treat. I kind of think with Buck, and maybe I'm in the minority here, whether you like him or not, I think the moment feels bigger when he's on the broadcast. And I think that's a big deal. I think when you have somebody that has become as established as he has been, and I know that Smoltz has done this for a long time, but I think embracing this role, and I think both of them, as you said, they know how to let the game breathe a little bit, means a lot. To me, it feels like it's a big game. It's a big deal when Joe's on the call. And the fact that he's been doing this since the late 1990s builds up that rapport and that reputation. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I don't know if I would really change a thing. I thought Brian Anderson did a really nice job during the NLCS games. I thought he was outstanding. I think he's certainly someone who's been doing a lot of games with the Brewers on a local level, is very good. But it's kind of crazy. We had this great opportunity here to change the landscape of the broadcast world for baseball, and here we are like, yeah, no, we'd probably just keep it all the same. That makes perfect sense. Anything else in the World Series that you guys are amping to get into or something that's caught your eye that I might have missed? Joe, I'll start with you.
I mean, there's the pre- and post-game booths with David Ortiz and Keith Hernandez joining A-Rod, Frank Thomas, and Kevin Burkhardt, but I really don't have much to say about that crew because, honestly, I don't see much of a need for the pre- and post-game shows with Twitter and the internet and all that going on right now. I don't need to tune into the game a half hour to an hour before it starts. It just seems a little bit superfluous to me, but I know the pregame and postgame shows aren't going away, so I can't really get too deep
into
it. Well,
let me follow up with you on that, because it's obviously a point of importance, especially for Fox Sports 1, who in what this is year number 3 for them, is still trying to to get themselves even more on the map than where they currently are. Like, if you're running Fox Sports 1 and you have, okay, we have Alex Rodriguez and David Ortiz, just to start, and Kevin Burkhardt is driving the show, and then there's Keith Hernandez and Frank Dobbs. You got some big names. How would you better utilize them to try and say, hey, this is some big star power. You know, how do we make sure that we get more people tuned into us?
It's really strange because I don't think a lot of people are going to tune in just because of who they have. I don't think someone's going to say, oh, David Ortiz is on this. I have to watch it now. I wasn't going to before. But you have all these huge personalities. And we saw last year when Pete Rose was with the crew, that partnership with Alex Rodriguez kind of went viral for a bit. And they really played on that for the time they were together. And I think it's going to be a thing that they kind of have to build on. Like next year in studio during the regular season, they're not going to have David Ortiz. They're not going to have Keith Hernandez. They're not going to be able to build on that. These aren't guys that are going to kind of be around next season, maybe next postseason, but not next year during the regular season. And I don't know if this is something we're going to look at as, hey, remember when David Ortiz was an analyst? Oh, that was funny. Or if we're going to look at it like, oh, this was the beginning of his career as an analyst and he became such a big thing. I just think they need to look at people that are kind of going to be in this for the long haul, like kind of ESPN with Mark Teixeira this year. They kind of bought in with him and featured him and David Ross a lot.
Yeah.
And they're like kind of the guys that you're going to be seeing on TV a lot more. And I just don't know if Fox is really getting that with Hernandez and Ortiz.
Andrew, would you change anything about Fox's pre- and post-game coverage? Would there be something in particular that you'd want to either add on or change around?
Yeah, I mean, I think Joe makes good points on a number of fronts there. I think it isn't necessarily anything that they're building on during the year, but I think that for what they're doing right now, I think it works pretty well. I mean, I'm usually not a pre- and post-game show guy either. They don't usually add much value to me. But I found that for this series and for this postseason, I've been watching a decent amount. And a lot of that's because of the chemistry of the panel and because of their interactions. I think it's fun seeing the mix of personalities. I was curious how they were going to replace Pete Rose. And I think that the combination of Keith Hernandez and David Ortiz has actually been a really good fit there. And it's interesting to me to see the way those guys interact. I really like seeing the way that they have them interacting with players, where they're all asking different questions of the players they're interviewing. I think that really reveals a lot about the panelists' personalities. And then I love when they get really into specific points where they talk about specific baseball things, about particular approaches, particular hitting strategies or whatever. The one thing I would maybe change is I'd add somebody with a pitching perspective to that panel.
Yeah.
Or at least have a couple of pitchers maybe on a side set or whatever that you could talk to occasionally, because I do feel that that's missing somewhat. But other than that, I think they're doing very well with what they have, and they've made a post-game show entertaining for some people like me who don't normally watch them.
Yeah, it's a great point. A lot of heavy hitters, both literally and figuratively, on that panel. So I think a pitching perspective would be great. Pedro is somebody that I always love watching, whether it be on the TBS panel or the times that he comes in for MLB Network. I don't know if they could get him on loan for the World Series, but Pedro and Poppy to add on to that panel would certainly be outstanding. I want to move on from World Series coverage and get back into something that we sort of began the initial conversation on a couple weeks ago during our previous podcast, and that was the awkward nature of ESPN and Barstool coming together. And the last time we chatted, Barstool still had a show on ESPN. That is no longer the case. Joe, I'll start with you on this one. Now that Barstool and ESPN have gone their separate ways, what's the main takeaway from this? What ultimately went completely and totally wrong to the point where it was such a brief relationship, nobody really knew what was going on in this situation?
Like, what did ESPN really expect was going to happen here? I don't think people were just going to kind of let the whole Barstool thing kind of just brush it aside and they were going to be totally fine with it. I think that's what ESPN's management expected was going to happen, but clearly it didn't happen that way. There was this huge backlash within the company, and I mean, the show lasted one episode and they got rid of it. And it was, I don't want to say it was disappointing to see that. But I just don't think that ESPN really thought this through. That's what I was saying 2 weeks ago when we did our last podcast and we talked about. They just didn't know what they were getting themselves into. They thought it was just going to be like some other Embassy Row production that has a huge cult following and might be able to cultivate a big audience, but it didn't. It was Barstool, who has a huge cult audience, but it also has its fair share of detractors. And that's what they ended up getting. The detractors spoke, and they spoke loudly, and now ESPN has egg on their face. And it's kind of strange that throughout this whole thing, ESPN comes off looking worse than Barstool, in my opinion.
Do you agree with that, Andrew, that ESPN sort of really screwed the pooch and put themselves in a situation that they likely could have very easily avoided?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think the interesting thing here is I think this really shows us a lot about ESPN. ESPN is very concerned about critical perception of the company. They're very concerned about comments that are made about ESPN internally and externally. And then it blows my mind that they didn't really research who they were teaming up with here and what the reaction would be to about them. And in particular, that they didn't research the things that Barstool personalities had said about ESPN and about some of ESPN's specific employees in the past. This stuff was not a secret. Everyone knew that Barstool had this massive amount of critics out there. A lot of everyone knew that teaming up with ESPN would take a lot of flack, and ESPN just then decided to go ahead with it anyway, and then decided to change course completely once they saw exactly what the reaction would be. And to me, it's sort of crazy that ESPN is willing to, I think they need to do either one thing or the other thing. I think they either need to say, okay, we're making this decision and we're sticking with it, or we're going to listen to what people are saying and we're going to change our views based on that. But they keep on going with these middle of the road approaches of, oh, we're going to sign on with Barstool, but then too many people are mad, so we're going to quit it. Or with the Jemele Hill thing, oh, well, we didn't like what she said, we're not going to support her fully, and then we're going to suspend her a bit later over something, making everyone mad because of this, because they're trying to play it down the middle. You can't really play it down the middle with something like this. There's huge amounts of very passionate people on both sides, and ESPN really should have figured that out.
Do you think at any point in this they consider this a win, knowing that more and more people that were against Barstool at least feel like, okay, now we're finally being heard by our company. We finally feel like people are listening from the top down. That maybe in some ways this is a win for ESPN. And consequently, was this a benefit for Barstool, knowing that everybody, they tend to thrive amidst controversy? So I guess, is it a win for either of these two sides in any way, shape, or form, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say if it's a win for either side, it's probably a win for Barstool, because everyone is talking about them over the past week or so. Everyone that may or may not have heard of Barstool before, they're the ones that are talking about them and looking into what they're doing and what they're saying and consuming the product. And whether they like it or not, they have built up their brand just a little bit more right now. And that's what Barstool wanted this whole time, and that's what they got. And I still don't know like what the hell ESPN was trying to accomplish with this. They didn't accomplish a thing. They just ended up burying themselves even further with their own people. It blows my mind.
All right, well, we'll move on from Barstool, because there's still lots to get into here on the Awful Announcing Podcast. This is the roundtable version. Joe Lucia, Andrew Buchholz with me, Ben Heisler, coming up in just a little bit. An opportunity for you guys to win $50 to Amazon by playing our game with clips from our friends over at Clip It. Also, Rory Brown, the president of Bleacher Report, will join our president, Ben Koo. That's coming up in just a little bit on the podcast. It's a conversation that you're not going to want to miss. One other component that I want to get into with regards to some of the news from the last week or so is the comments made by the CEO of The Athletic. And it caught a lot of people by surprise, but I'm not necessarily sure why, because I think these are types of conversations that a lot of CEOs are having when it comes to competition. And for those that missed the quote, this is from Alex Mather, who is the co-founder of The Athletic. The quote was, quote, "We will wait and we will have every local paper out and let them continuously bleed until we are the last one standing. We will suck them dry of their best talent at every moment. We will make business extremely difficult for them." Andrew, I'll start with you. Is this really as outrageous as people have made it out to be? Because it almost sounds like a fairly efficient and solid business plan, considering that the Athletic numbers and subscription models have continued to go up and up, and they've gotten some exceptional talent along the way. That to me, it came across as maybe a bit harsh, but very honest along the way as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of why this became big deal and why this provoked controversy is that the Athletic has really, like, they've tried to build this reputation as we're the good guys. We're the ones supporting local journalism. We're the ones who we're not doing slideshows. We're not doing clickbait. We're not pivoting to video, and we're giving good writers jobs. And then these comments from the CEO, they may have been what they were discussing internally all of the time, and they may have been what you can see from the outside as sort of a cynical business strategy, but that wasn't their public approach. And I think the real problem here is that the CEO said this in a New York Times article. If he's saying this in an internal company meeting or whatever, and it gets reported, it's not as big of a deal. But when this is the public face you're putting on your company to the world, that's going to create a lot more controversy, especially when you've sort of tried to build yourself as the savior of journalism. And the thing to keep in mind here too is that a lot of people are saying, well, what's the big deal with this? Any company would do this. Well, went. And the thing is, the journalism industry is really different than a lot of other businesses in that there's very few players in it that have really like global ambitions or even national ambitions.
Right.
There's a bunch of local ambitions, but even the local papers, they're not often out trying to necessarily kill each other. I mean, they have been at times. There have been newspaper wars and so on. But especially when you move past the local to the national and to the world, there's far more of a sense that, well, all these journalists are on the same side. They're all on the same team. They're all in journalism as an industry. And these comments, I think, really like flew in the face of that and really made it seem much more straight tech venture, straight business venture. We're out to just stomp on everybody else. And it really shouldn't be surprising that people were upset about that.
Do you think that's a fair characterization, Joe?
Yeah, I do. And I think a lot of people kind of put The Athletic on a pedestal over the last couple months. They kind of thought of it as, oh, it's something different. It's not a business. It's not out to just make money. But that's the point of any business, to make money. And I think the comments were a little harsh in the sense that they were pretty blunt. But I mean, that should be the goal of every business, to defeat their competition. You're not going to try to survive hand in hand with your competitors. You're trying to prevail over them and eventually take market share from them. And I just think that the way he said it really rubbed people the wrong way. And if he was a bit more diplomatic in his approach, then there probably wouldn't have been such a backlash to it.
You know what? I think I see it from both points. And I'm glad both of you guys presented it in this way. It kind of reminds me, and maybe this is a terrible example, and you guys can call me out for it if it is, but I think part of the reason why... remember back when Tiger Woods, it was either, what, 08 or 09, the joke that we have on our radio show in Kansas City, my host Carrington Harrison always says, is that Tiger got into the Escalade and then walked out as Eldrick. Like, the whole perception changed about Tiger once more and more information started to come out. We thought Tiger was this family man and somebody that was sort of core to his values. And, you know, he sold us Tag Heuer watches because that's what the classy man wears. And all of a sudden you find out about Denny's waitresses and or Perkins waitresses, whatever it was. It's the same thing. Hopefully they're not a sponsor of the podcast at any point. But you get what I'm saying in the sense of, like, we all felt like we were duped. And I think of that Denzel Washington line from Malcolm X, like, we've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, run amok, led astray. And so, to Andrew's point, the idea of journalists helping other journalists be successful and helping the journalism world remain successful based off of this business model, I think is a fair characterization. The Athletic, when it first debuted, said this is a way to get a lot of really talented, smart journalists the opportunity to write. And just by giving us, you know, a cup of coffee a week, you're able to keep us afloat and get some really good writing out there in the death of the writing era for some sites. Consequently, though, to Joe's point, you have a situation where they're still trying to get people to come to their site and they're not apologetic about it. And so I think that dichotomy is fascinating, knowing that you might have sold yourself a certain way, but at the same time, maybe if you sort of look beyond the surface, you knew exactly what it was. And I don't know if you guys have any further thoughts on this, but I think that element of it is fascinating.
I think something that sort of came to mind as we were talking about this is, in some ways, it's reminiscent to me of the launch of Fox Sports One and how they came in with, we're going to be the ESPN alternative. Yeah. We're going to take on ESPN. We're going to challenge ESPN. And they weren't the first to do it. NBC Sports Network was around before that, as Versus in particular. CBS Sports Network was around before that. But those two companies really sort of, they've essentially played nice with ESPN. They've never tried to be ESPN. They've never tried to say, we're going to destroy ESPN. Fox did, and I think it's had pros and cons for them. It brought them a lot of attention. It got them a lot of initial advanced publicity and so on. But it's also meant a lot of people have been out to really point out what they're doing wrong and how they don't match up to ESPN in a way that maybe wouldn't have happened if they hadn't been so brazen about those comparisons. And I think you get some of the same thing with The Athletic and with how this has unfolded. I think at first, and it's interesting because they tried to do it sort of both ways. They tried to start with that nicer approach. They tried to start with the world here to support local journalism.
What make happy family, right?
And then you get these comments from the CEO, and it goes a very different way. And I think it can work. I mean, that can be a strategy. If you want to say, we should be the only thing you read, we should be the only thing you subscribe to, we're going to knock out all the local papers. I mean, whatever, that'll get you a lot of attention. It certainly got you a lot of buzz. But the thing to keep in mind here, too, is that journalism isn't necessarily a zero-sum thing, right? Like, there are going to be lots of people who can and do subscribe to both The Athletic and something else, to Sports Illustrated, to a local paper or whatever. And that's why you don't often see such blatant head-to-head comparisons and attacks in this field as you do in maybe some other ones. So I think it's a bold strategy. It's one that's saying what they're probably all thinking, but I don't think it's one that you necessarily should make your public strategy, because it ticks off a lot of people.
Joe, any final thoughts on this?
No, not really. I think we covered both sides of it pretty well. It's really not an issue that, like, there's going to be some kind of consensus agreement on. I think both sides of this argument really are valid, and it's going to be interesting to see what they do going forward with their business model and trying to not piss off readers while also making money.
All right, I'll end the show and I'll end the roundtable with this question to you guys, because it's always fun to come up with some predictions and things that maybe we should keep our eye out for and maybe start to predict and see and crystallize along the way. Any sports media predictions that you guys are seeing on the horizon that you want to go ahead and weigh in on? And when it happens, then we can proudly praise you on the podcast. And if it doesn't happen, then we can make fun of you or just forget that you had even those conversations to begin with. Anything standing out for you over the next couple months that we should keep an eye out for? And Joe, I'll start with you.
The only real TV deal that's kind of coming up on the horizon is the UFC TV deal, which expires at the end of 2018. and I'm really struggling to get a read on it, where they might go. My incredibly bold prediction is that the UFC, for all their flirting with all these other outlets they end up doing, I think they're going to end up staying with Fox, and I think their total gain on their rights deal, I think it's going to be less than 20% a year more than what they're making now. But that's a little exact, but it's not exactly out on a huge limb there.
Where are you going with your bold prediction, Andrew?
I think my bold prediction is that we haven't seen the last of ESPN and political controversies. I mean, I don't know how bold that is. It's probably somewhat expected, but I think we're going to see another incident, maybe not quite on the Jemele Hill scale, but I think we're going to see another incident somewhat approaching that at some point in the next few months. And the reason is, I mean, they're trying to have these guidelines of what people can say, what people can't. They're trying to limit what people are commenting on and avoid a repeat of that. But the thing is, sports are so intertwined with politics at every second in 2017, and ESPN has a lot of opinionated people, and they're paying them to be opinionated people and to discuss everything to do with sports. A lot of time, that's going to lead to political controversy. That's going to lead to comments that could potentially create another stir for ESPN. And I think if that really gets taken notice of by more prominent right-wing media, then it eventually makes its way to the White House. It maybe makes its way to the president again. And I think we get another one of those firestorms.
All right. Yes or no, Andrew, ESPN will move on from NFL rights. Yes or no?
I think no. I think it's very interesting that this is being floated and that this discussion has happened, because for so long it was just a no, they're not going to do that because it's in the contract language. It's amazing that they've managed to get out of the contract language, and that's what makes this even a possibility to discuss. But I still think that having some NFL is very important to them. The NFL is having its ratings issues, but it's still one of the biggest properties on TV. Monday Night Football is having its issues, but it's still huge for them. It's still one of their biggest draws, and it is still just an incredible amount of leverage for them in carriage negotiations, even if they've managed to get out of the contracts. If they lose the NFL, sure, that's, you could save a lot of money, but I think you are really going to have to cut that per subscriber rate. You're not going to have cable companies paying you as much as they are right now if you can't say, we've got the NFL. And so I think they will find a way to hang on to it, but they may wind up cutting back further elsewhere.
Yes or no, Joe, ESPN loses their NFL coverage?
I'm actually going to one-up Andrew. I'm going to say no, they do not lose their NFL coverage, but they do lose Monday Night Football, and they end up going in on the Thursday night package. How about that?
That might have been the best bold prediction of all the bold predictions and the white hot, red hot takes that we've been known for on the Awful Announcing Podcast. So I don't know if we can end it better than over there with that one. That's Joe Lucia, Andrew Buchholz. Read their fine work over at awfulannouncing.com. Give them a follow on Twitter as well. Also, make sure you follow Awful Announcing on the Tweet Machine as well. Coming up in just a little bit, you'll hear from Rory Brown, the president of Bleacher Report, with Ben Koo. But on the other side, your chance to win $50 to Amazon.com. All you got to do is name the clip. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by Clip It. Download the Clip It app today on iOS and Android.
Welcome back. It is game time on the Awful Announcing Podcast. It is presented by our friends over at Clip It. Download the Clip It app today over on Android and on iOS. We are pleased to be joined by our buddy Mike in D.C. Mike, how you doing today?
I'm good, Ben. How are you?
I'm good. You ready to play our game? It's a very easy one and an opportunity for you to win $50 to Amazon.com. You ready to play?
Awesome. Let's do it.
Okay, here's how the game will work. I have a couple clips for you courtesy of our friends over at Clip It. I need you to identify the clip. If you do so, that is $25 to Amazon.com. You get them both right. That's $50. And if you get none of them right, well, that is on you. And that is something that you'll have to take home to your friends and family, knowing that you had a great opportunity and you let it slip away. So no pressure. But here we go. This is clip number one, Mike. And this clip comes from a NFL announcer who was trying to find something positive to happen. And it turns out that a cat running down the field in the middle of a game ended up being that moment. Take a listen.
Extension. I mean, and doesn't even get fazed that there's people around. Just look, ooh, look at the change of direction. Does he get both feet in right here at the end, Jim?
Well, he turns it uphill.
Ooh. That's way too much fun at this point. I feel like we're just like in that tired mode where you're delirious and you're laughing at silly things. My kids have a way of doing that every night.
All right, so Mike in D.C., if you can tell me the name of the NFL announcer that had a lot of fun breaking down the cat's ability on the football field, who might that announcer be?
Ooh. How recent was the play?
It was very recent. It was almost as recent as last Thursday night.
Is it Tony Romo?
It was Tony Romo, Mike. I feel like I kind of gave you that one. I got to put you over the edge for this one. I don't know if I can be so kind the next time around. But are you ready? You got $25 to Amazon.com, an opportunity to go to 50. You ready?
Let's do it.
Okay. Katie Nolan made her debut on ESPN on this show. Mike in D.C., I need you to name the show. Take a listen.
Poppy, are you intrigued? Oh, see, I'm very intrigued. But listen, you know what I'm going to be looking for? I'm going to be looking at the old man. You know, every time Lonzo Ball gets a bad call from the referee, he's going to go into the court and strike a big argument with that referee. I'm telling you something. That guy is a mean one.
All right.
That's what is going
I'm
to
here
happen.
I'm for it, by the way.
That's
a
right.
A bad call on the court tonight and LeVar Ball runs on?
Yes.
Yes, please.
Sometimes fathers should just stay out of their son's career. Am I right?
All right, Mike in D.C., I need to know the name of the show that Katie Nolan made her ESPN debut on. What is the name of the show?
Highly Questionable.
There it is, Highly Questionable. Mike in D.C., you are this week's winner. $50 to Amazon.com is yours just by getting both of the clips right, courtesy of our friends over at Clipping. Congratulations, Mike. You know what you're going to use the $50 on?
I'm going to get something useful, that's for sure. I got to take a look at the options. I know Amazon's got a lot to offer.
There you go. That's the perfect way to do it. Mike in D.C., thank you for playing our game, and thank you for listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Rory Brown, the president of Bleacher Report, is coming up next with our president, Ben Koo. This is the Awful Announcing Podcast.
Welcome back to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
All right, back at it on the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by Clip It, the number one way to share your favorite movie clips, TV clips, sports highlights. Hopefully I'll be sharing one of Indiana beating Wisconsin in football this weekend. It's doubtful, but I'm hoping to be able to do it. Rory Brown, the president of Bleacher Report, sat down with our president, Ben Koo. The two of them began their conversation reminiscing about how they actually go back a long way.
What's interesting about Rory is we know each other for over 20 years. We went to the same high school, same class, same group of friends, and me and Rory are actually in the same fantasy football league to this day. And that's how I largely keep in touch with him. But was really excited to have Rory on, ask him about his role at Bleacher Report, the history of the company, what they're working on now. So welcome, Rory.
Thanks, Ben. And my terrible fantasy team this year aside, it's great to be on.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't going to go there, but you did draft Deshaun Kizer willingly. I'm not sure what the thinking was there, but obviously, that's going to hold you back this year.
Hey, you got to take a gamble on keepers sometimes. I'd say Kizer is the least of my worries. I think the bigger issue is I drafted the entire Atlanta Falcons offense, and that's not working out too well.
Yeah, well, it can't be your year every year. I believe you won 3 years ago or 2 years ago. So, you know, what goes around comes around. So one of the things, Rory, that I kind of wanted to go through, and I had a hard time thinking of like a structured way to get a history of Bleacher Report as well as your role at Bleacher Report, but I came up with this way of kind of digging through all those details. What I'd like for you to do is go through every single office location you worked at Bleacher Report and kind of go through what your role was at the time at that office, who ran the company, how many employees Bleacher Report had at that time, and who you think the largest competitor, or your biggest competitor was that you kind of viewed as your competitor at that time. So four things: what you were doing, who ran the company, the size of the company, and who was your biggest competitor for all of the various locations. Because I believe when you started in 2008, you were in that small office right across from the Giants Stadium, and now, you know, a lot has changed. So I thought it would be an interesting way for you to kind of retrace how you and the company grew.
All right. Okay. This will be fun. So let's see if I can remember all this stuff. So, yeah, so I started with the company in October of 2008. So I've been there, I think, as of a couple weeks ago, 9 years. And, yeah, we were on Townsend Street by the Caltrain station and, as you said, Giants Stadium in San Francisco. And let's see, the size of the company, it was about 15 or 20 people, about 12 or 13 full-timers at the time when I started. Who was the boss? Well, there was the original founders were still there at the time. Dave Finocchio, who is my boss now, was my boss then as well. He's our founder and CEO. And let's see, what else was I supposed to remember about each chapter?
What you were doing and who you guys kind of viewed at that time as your biggest competitor. So what were you doing when you started at Bleacher Report?
Yeah, so I started so basically I came in essentially as a manager on the content side, and we were trying to figure out what topics, you know, resonated most with readers. And Dave and his co-founders, when they set things up, I mean, they had a mantra that I think still really rings true today, which is like, hey, let's make the experience better for sports fans. And at the time that, you know, I think you had a lot of major sports media companies covering a lot of the same stuff, a lot of the big national stories. And, you know, I mean, you know, Ben, I think this resonates with you and me. We grew up in the Bay Area as Oakland A's fans. And even within the Bay Area, you know, San Francisco Giants coverage was a lot bigger than Oakland A's coverage. Just bigger fan base, bigger audience, nicer, new stadium. Unfortunately, the A's still have the same stadium. But, you know, it was all about finding those white spaces of what teams and topics do people want to get more content about. And, you know, at the time, search traffic was really a great source of data to figure that out. And, you know, I use this example a lot when I talk internally and to other folks, but it really does, I mean, it's really accurate that we started to figure out that, like, for a team like the Cleveland Browns, we saw fans start to search for NFL draft content in November. It's like, well, why were they doing that? Because, like,
Sean Watson is the quarterback.
Yeah, exactly. Like, the Browns aren't very good by early November. So people start to look ahead to the draft, and we all do that as our teams go up and down. And, you know, I think right now, I'm a Warriors fan, so I'm dialed into every game of the season. I'm also a Niners fan, and they're not having the best year, and so we're already looking ahead to the draft. So, you know, the same person can be have different habits depending on what their teams are and what information's out there. So, you know, for us, that was a good time or a good signal to figure out, hey, like, maybe people are more interested in the NFL draft than the TV audience suggests. And, you know, it makes sense now when you look back. It's like, well, the NFL draft include, you know, that's all 32 teams that are part of the NFL draft, and the Super Bowl is just two. But, you know, the Super Bowl is this big spectacle on TV and gets talked about forever. But, you know, the draft for us early on was one of the biggest events we had at BR, and it still is something we do really well, because, you know, it's one thing to watch on TV for a couple hours, but it's another thing if you're looking for information of what that fourth round pick is going to mean for your team, and to actually have, you know, credible information and analysis that makes you smarter as a fan. So that was my job, to come up with those topics and to really just test and learn a bunch. And it was exhausting, but really, really fun.
And back then, who were you? I mean, you guys were small, 15 people. Like, who were you like, we got to beat these guys? Who did you guys kind of compete with? Was it other sports startups like SB Nation or Yard Barker where I worked, or were you guys kind of eyeing other people back then?
I mean, I think for us, it was like, we actually, look, I'm not trying to punt on the question. It's kind of a juicy one, but we didn't really like pinpoint one property. I think we were what we were looking to do was build audience though, for sure. And look, if you're building audience, it's hard not to compare yourself against, you know, at the time there was money being, you know, kind of delicately placed on other bets with our industry. You mentioned a few, smaller properties like SB Nation, Yard Barker, et cetera. But then you had, you know, your kind of the old guard, you know, the NBC Sports, the Fox Sports, the ESPN that had bigger ComScore numbers and were looking to measure in traditional audience. And I mean, it just shows you how quickly this industry changes. Here we are 9 years later and, you know, ComScore is still, a source of measurement for audience, but it really doesn't tell the whole story because it doesn't show about a brand's reach on social and, you know, the content experiences people are having off of your own platform.
So you're there in 2008, and I think your next move got you a little bit more towards the financial district. I think you were on Mission for a little bit. Same routine there. You're a year or two later. How big is the company? What are you working on? Who are you guys competing with, if anyone at that time?
We moved. Yeah, I think that was 2000 and I want to say 2011. We moved, yes, closer to downtown San Francisco. It's funny, we moved in that office and it seems so big compared to the tiny office we had across from the Caltrain station. And we thought, oh my gosh, we'll be here for years and years. I think we were there for like 14 months or something, like hilarious. Actually, no, it was earlier than 2011 is when we moved to our current spot. It might have been 2010, even now that I think about it. We were there for like a year. And so we had like, I want to say like 45, 50 maybe people in that office. And let's see if, so basically my role then started to switch from, you know, just pure content to figuring out how where content and programming overlapped. So, around that time we started to bring on some extremely talented people, who built out our newsletter program. And this is still in the old office, but it really started to really explode and get big in the Mission Street office where we moved next. We started to build out the foundation for our app, which was really, really exciting. And, you know, our homepage, like Bleacher Report was becoming a more regular destination for a lot of people. So, figuring out, you know, how do you program all these things? What types of people are seeing your experience, on the homepage versus what demographics are seeing it, you know, are signing up for newsletters and who's downloading our app? And, you know, this distribution, I think, is one of those things that doesn't get talked about enough in this industry where, like, you know, there's the whole saying of content is king. And, yeah, like, you've got to have good content. But, I mean, look now. It's like there's so much good content out there. And I think this goes back to your competition question. It's not just about sports. It's about, like it's just competing for time and eyeballs at this point. Like, I mean, when Pokemon Go, like, became a thing, like, people were interacting with that versus like sports content or watching live games or like looking at a sports app. Like that's just how it works at this point. So, you know, it's really easy to, and we get, you know, I think painted in this light a lot of like, oh, look out for Bleacher Report. They're, you know, they're better at ESPN than this and they're better at somebody else with that. And it's like, yeah, that's fine. And that's great. But, you know, at the same time, like, you know, we're also competing against the very platforms we're featured on sometimes. If, you know, someone's spending all their time on Snapchat, you know, that's great. They're coming into contact with the Bleach Report brand because we're a Snapchat Discover partner. But, if they're spending all that time in Snapchat, it means they might not be spending it, you know, in our own app or with our content. So it's really important to create, you know, content experiences that are very compelling, but also think about how those how that content's distributed and where people spend their time. And that's really what I started to kind of wrap my head around with a very talented group of people at that office. And, you know, I think credit to Dave, who's always one step ahead in thinking about where the distribution is going. And it's put the company in a place of great success.
So you're at that office for a little bit, and then you kind of move toward, I think, within the finance district. I think that's one of the offices I haven't been to yet, and I think you're there still, at least your San Francisco location. You're on the East Coast, and I think that was probably where the Turner acquisition takes place. So, you know, when you move into there, or, you know, when you go there, how big is the company? What are you working on? What's kind of the focus of the company?
I think in 2011, we moved to our existing space, which is just on the north side of Market Street in San Francisco. And, at the time we had basically a floor and a half. We had a main floor and a mezzanine floor. And now we have those two floors plus two more in the same building. So it's been a great space for us in San Francisco. And yeah, the acquisition happened in 2012, which was really exciting. But I'd say that office, let's see, what did we start to, I was in that office till 2013, when I started my pilgrimage east, but, you know, I think that's where the app really started to take off. We really started to figure out and embrace curation too. I mean, that was, you know, that's been a strength of ours from the get-go with our newsletter programs and as we built the app, but, we started to see this great organic movement of people downloading our app because we weren't afraid to curate the best content about teams and topics that people cared about, you know, whether Bleach Report made that content or not. And sometimes it was Bleach Report content. We've always made a lot of great content at BR. But sometimes it wasn't because you had, you know, a beat columnist covering a team for 15 years. Like, no one's going to cover that team better than that columnist. So we've got to curate that content, even though we send traffic out of our app and, you know, to that newspaper's website. And we're okay with that because the app, you know, has been and will be and continue to be home base for a lot of sports fans who want that complete experience. So that's really where the app started to take off, and credit to not just our content and programming groups, but obviously our product and engineering teams. I think, you know, that office was really fun because we started to develop this war room setting during live events as well, where, you know, historically we do a lot of work leading up to events and then just kind of see that plan go into action as far as how we would cover things, how we would curate things. We really started to figure out social in that office as well. And kind of, you know, I think when you ask a random person off the street, you know, what do you like about Bleach Report, our social voice and the experience we create on social channels is often at the top of the list for people, especially young sports fans, which we resonate really, really well with. So that's where we started to kind of figure out, like, okay, like, you know, this isn't just about, you know, covering an event or covering a game or covering the NBA finals or the draft the way you see it on TV. Like, let's curate and let's create content that's built for these social channels that we know is really going to resonate and people are going to share like crazy. And I think that's where we developed that mentality, and we've been honing it over the last couple years, where now we have, you know, major hubs in San Francisco, New York, and London who are dedicated to doing just that, and I think we're best in class at it.
And how many employees, when you kind of first moved in there, were there, you know, or did you guys have, and where are you guys at now in terms of that San Francisco office as you've added floors after the Turner acquisition?
I actually don't know, like, the exact breakdown for office. Like, right, I think now we're at 450-ish full-timers. So, and I think New York probably has more than San Francisco. It's pretty close. So, you know, New York and San Francisco have got a big chunk of that. We've got some people that are also on our sales team in L.A. and Chicago and Atlanta. And then we've got the London office, which is up to 30-something people now.
Oh, wow.
As well. Yeah.
And then you mentioned your pilgrimage east, I think it was Chicago and then New York. you know, how did the company change? How did your role change as, you know, we get into some of these more recent years?
Yeah, post-acquisition, the company let me move to Chicago. So at the time, I was heading up content operations, which is the intersection of content with all these other groups, whether it be programming, product, sales, you name it. So people I managed were all over the place. So went to Chicago and was a relatively close flight to all of them, and worked out of the Turner office, which is really fun, the sales office. And, you know, outside of, it's the first time I'd ever lived outside California, which was interesting to do a Chicago winter for sure. But really, really fun, but it was a sales office. And so you had, you know, people that were, you know, pre-acquisition at Bleach Report, and now, you know, we're working alongside folks within Turner Sports, but also the other Turner brands. You had CNN, you had Adult Swim, you had Cartoon Network, you had, you know, all these other groups under one roof, which was kind of a great way to get a crash course in Turner, which I really appreciated, and, you know, made friends there in that office that, you know, keep in close contact to this day. So it was, you know, that was a good education of the Turner business. And then I was in New York a lot, and then eventually moved out here to full on run the content department, essentially, from soup to nuts. So that was in 2014, and then became chief content officer, and then that turned into being named president in 2016. So it's been fun. You know, I think it's fun for me to come up the content side, but I feel like the most fun parts for me have been to learn about other parts of the business and figure out, you know, where content leads versus where revenue leads and content can support. And I think especially with like our new CRO and CMO, Howard Mittman, who's been an awesome addition to the team a couple months ago, and he comes from the publishing world, where he was running big aspects of GQ and Wired and other really big brands. It's been really fun to figure out how we continue to grow this brand, not just, you know, for the next year, but like what does Bleacher Report look like 3 or 4 years from now, knowing, you know, how crazy this landscape is and how quickly things change.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. The reason I wanted you to run through all that is I think it's a pretty crazy story. You don't see people this day and age, especially digital companies and startups, doing, you know, almost a full decade at one place and kind of coming in from someone with no digital experience. If you don't know too much about Rory, I believe the only position you had previous to Bleacher Report was being a writer at a newspaper. Kind of makes the leap to the Silicon Valley digital startup world and, you know, more or less gets a promotion a year for 7 or 8 years and becomes the president. And I actually shared this with someone that you met who, you know, we had talked about potentially working together at the company I worked at, and we were kind of catching up, and he asked how Bleacher Report was doing, and I said, you know that guy who came in, like, 8 or 9 years ago who was like a newspaper writer? Yeah, he's the president. And I felt it was like the Julia Roberts, you work on commission moment for you. So I think it's pretty remarkable you, as well as the company, to just kind of walk through that 13-person office across the ballpark, which was getting crowded to, you know, offices in London, New York, Atlanta, L.A., you know, San Francisco. Within the space, it's definitely one of the bigger success stories, and it's certainly cool that you were there from pretty much the beginning all the way to now.
So I'm the Julia Roberts of sports media. That's interesting. That's a new one for me.
Yeah, I mean, we got to make that into a shirt or something.
thanks for that. I appreciate it. And I think, like, look, I mean, credit to Dave who hired me and you know, took a shot. And I think, like, it just shows, I don't know, like, we've done a lot of that. We've hired people at BR where, you know, you bring them in and you just realize, like, okay, like, this person just thinks about things a little bit differently. And that includes some people that, you know, it's not like they have extensive experience in sports either. They're really good at figuring out, you know, whether it's on the content side or product side or, you know, understanding distribution and especially how young people, you know, what kind of content resonates with them and how they behave on various platforms. Like, it's, you know, it's fun to bring those people in and, you know, they're huge sports fans and they didn't really ever think they'd get to work in sports like this. And it's fun to go to war with folks like that every day.
So I wanted to kind of ask you about Bleacher Report now, a few questions. So one thing is, like, early on in Bleacher Report's history, people were kind of tough on the content, whether it was too many slideshows or just articles from, you know, you kind of open or early ended. It was kind of an open publishing platform, and obviously that's evolved. But, I, you know, some of that stigma is still there. But what I was kind of explaining to some people is, you know, I'm not sure how large of component .com is for you right now, because you have the TeamStream app, which you talked about. You have your newsletter program, and your social accounts are, like, kind of killing, you know, the engagement and growth that we're seeing at, like, the larger players as well. So if you kind of look at those four buckets of social feed, social accounts, newsletter curation, and then your app, I'd be kind of curious, like, is .com out of those four buckets still the biggest kind of most significant part of your business, or has it been eclipsed by, you know, potentially one of those other areas that you guys operate in?
I mean, I think it depends, you know, what kind of metrics you're talking about. I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, I will say, like, it's no secret. Like, if you know what you're doing at all in this day and age, like, you should be getting a lot more eyeballs via social distribution than you should on a .com website. And if you're not doing that, you probably aren't doing something right on social. So, look, we have a big, you know, O&O, called owned and operated audience of people that are going directly to Bleacher Report, whether it's our website or our app. Which, you know, loyalty is very high in our app, and credit to the team that makes that a really compelling product. And we're constantly pushing ourselves to figure out new ways to do that. You know, the opportunity for growth is on social. And that's something that, you know, from BR standpoint, we embrace. I think there's been two key moments, and I credit Dave for recognizing both of them in the company's history. Well, there's been a lot of key moments, but I think when we talk about distribution, one was when we started to see a lot of our traffic and audience go from desktop to mobile, and it was happening pretty early on in the company's history. And, you know, rather than try and say, uh-oh, like, I don't know, will we be able to monetize, you know, mobile inventory the way we monetize desktop inventory, you know, it was like, well, we don't know, but this is happening. There's nothing we can do to fight it. If anything, it's like, look at us. We're all sitting around a table and we're all on our phones right now. So this is the future. And especially as, you know, sports fans or, you know, young sports fans get their first phone and they kind of figure out who they are as sports fans and what teams and topics and players and storylines they care about, like, they're not going to just do what, you know, Ben, like you and I did, like when we were growing up, which is just watch SportsCenter like on repeat all day, right? It's like, because that's how you got highlights, that's how you got information, and it's just a completely different era now. And so it's like we really embrace that. And I think, you know, credit not just to Dave, but our sales organization for saying, like, okay, now we've got to figure out, you know, how do we build compelling experiences so advertisers aren't going to look at us like we're crazy when we go into meetings and say, you know, at the time, 50%, then quickly became 60%, 70%, sometimes a lot more of our traffic is mobile. I mean, we see pockets where, you know, 90% plus is mobile around key events, because that's the majority of the time we all spend on the internet, is on our phones. So I think that was a big moment. The other one was the social, where we said, you know what, like, it's not really proven that we'll be able to monetize these opportunities, but, you know, what a great opportunity to get the brand in front of people and the right content experiences. So especially like with Instagram, like there was no real option to link back. People said, well, Instagram's nice for photos, but it's not, you know, it's not going to be a traffic generator. So what's the point of brands being on there? And, you know, I think we said, you know what, like it's a premium social network where people are putting their best content. You put an album of photos on Facebook. You put your favorite photo from the vacation on Instagram, which I know has changed a little bit with Instagram stories, but you get the point. So we said, well, what if we just like create really premium stuff and put it on Instagram and see how that resonates? And, you know, that goes back to that war room setting where we've got this crazy talented group of people who are communicating across multiple offices in real time and saying like, hey, we should build this really quick for Instagram. It'll perform really well and people will think higher of the BR brand. And now we're doing that with brands and monetizing those opportunities as well at scale, which is really exciting. So, you know, I think it just shows like, you know, to your original point, like, yeah, like social is where the reach is, not just for us, but when we partner with advertisers. So, you know, for eyeballs, that's the biggest one, but it's still really important that people have a great experience whether they're going to support.com or our app especially, which, you know, has millions and millions of loyal folks who we don't want to get lazy for those people. And we know there's a lot of content options out there, and we want them to keep picking Bleacher Report.
So you mentioned Instagram and just kind of passing it on to our listeners. If, you know, you've tried Bleacher Report in the past, or you didn't like the app, or, you know, you didn't like the newsletter or whatever, I still highly recommend them on social, particularly Instagram. They do a lot of cool stuff, a lot of funny stuff. And if you're just kind of someone who observes the industry, it looks like Rory and Bleacher Report are kind of they've cracked the code on how to work with advertisers. And recently, a lot of what they've been posting has been in conjunction with sponsors, and I think it's probably because you guys did a lot of heavy lifting early, you know, growing engagement and kind of figuring out how to put forth compelling content. But I would definitely say Bleacher Report has been kind of on the cutting edge of Instagram in terms of figuring out how to make it work for a content brand and now monetizing it. It's been certainly interesting to watch, and I think you're probably a year or two ahead of most of your competition there.
Yep. Yeah, it's a big point of focus for us. And I mean, it's one of the best opportunities to, you know, not just create content that's super engaging, but to learn new things. And we kind of view our social channels as this kind of the world's biggest focus group of sports fans, right? And if you create something on one platform, we think, like, I wonder if that will work on all the platforms, or should we tweak it, you know, versus what we put on Twitter versus what we put on Instagram. And you start to learn a lot about how people behave. And, you know, I think brands, when they work with us, they really value that knowledge we have at this point. And, you know, we get to hear from them. What problem are they looking to solve, and how do they want to reach people? And we create stuff that does that.
So, you know, we've talked a lot about social, and now I'm going to kind of take off my like interviewer hat, like professional hat, and put on the friend hat. Rory, you're very, you know, from a corporate perspective, you're very focused on social, and yet it doesn't drive me nuts, but, you know, it drives certain people in our fantasy football league a little nuts that you are not on Facebook, and you're not very active on Twitter. I don't know if I've seen a tweet from you in a long time. So I guess I'd be curious to, you know, so much of your job kind of involves figuring out what's going on social media, how people are using these platforms. Why are you not on Facebook? I don't think you've ever been on Facebook, if I recall. I'd be kind of curious as to how you kind of separate those two, you know, different ways of kind of embracing social between professional and personal.
Yeah, so I actually am on Facebook. I just don't have an account under my own name. So with Twitter, actually, I was actually just looking this morning for fun of, like, my data usage on my phone of what I use the most data on, and it's Instagram number one by far, and then Twitter number two. So, like, Twitter I love, but I just don't tweet that much myself, because I don't know, it's hard work, man, to like build up like a personal brand and stick with it, and, you know, try not to say something stupid and all that. Like, I'm trying to do this podcast without saying something stupid, like, let alone tweet things all day. So, you know, I think it's really important that everyone in the industry uses these things as consumers. And everyone kind of has their own platforms of choice, right? Like for me, it's Instagram. Like I like to create goofy Instagram stories about my like 2-year-old son as he learns to dribble a basketball. And I like those,
but I kind of miss the ping pong, the office ping pong politics and bragging that were first and foremost until you had Decker.
Oh yeah, I mean, ping pong has to take a back seat when you have a kid, but I do have a sign in my office that says number one pong player, which everyone else who plays ping pong at BR despises. So, you know, you got to pick your battles here. So I think, yeah, it's like everyone's got their preference, right? And I think it's important to stay in touch with what's going on with all the platforms. I mean, it's crazy how we were talking about this. I was out in Chicago meeting with our team out there and some clients, and we were just kind of having informal like conversations about the landscape. And like, I was saying like, look, like when I started at Bleacher Report 9 years ago, it's like Facebook wasn't even showing people content outside of like, you know, whoever was in your network, and Snapchat wasn't even a thing, and Twitter was barely a thing. And like, I mean, it just shows how crazy, you know, like it used to be, you know, the transition from network to cable television was a really big deal, and cable to the, you know, TV to, you know, the internet digital era was a really big deal. But you're talking about like many, many years, like in between these big steps. And I mean, it feels like there's like one every year at this point, if not more. The landscape shifts so fast. So, and that includes the platforms themselves. They're trying to stay a step ahead of each other and, you know, on top of, you know, what users are doing. And it's pretty remarkable. So yeah, so it's like, it's, I'm pretty tuned in to all the platforms, needless to say.
All right. So just to recap, you're on Facebook, but you're not friends with anyone in our fantasy football league. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm not terribly interested in, hearing about their, you know, they're bad beats in the fantasy world. I get enough of that.
All right. This could cause some drama. Just, you know, it's out there now. I don't know who will listen, and maybe we'll kind of guess through who might. So one thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, you've been at the company 9 years. The company is obviously kind of a leader across the board in a lot of different areas that we covered. But do you ever kind of look back and go, maybe we should have gone down a certain road? At certain points, it was reported that you guys were going to look at doing other verticals, so maybe like a pop culture Bleacher Report. You know, potentially, you know, I know a few years ago you guys talked with Adrian Wojnarowski about maybe doing something like the vertical. You know, you've had conversations with Bill Simmons, maybe looking at doing something like the Ringer. Do you ever kind of look at, you know, past some opportunities that maybe you never kind of came together that you go, you know, it would have been good if we did that, or maybe we should have done video bigger back then, or, you know, maybe we should have tried to get a TV show on, you know, on TNT before certain games, or, you know, do you kind of look at anything over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years when you guys were really kind of the force that you are now and go, you know, it would have been kind of interesting to pursue this opportunity?
That's a pretty good question. I mean, it's interesting. You know, one thing we honestly like could have moved faster on was social as a brand. And we deliberately took our time because, you know, let's see, like 4 or 5 years ago, social was viewed as a traffic source. You know, you saw a lot of publishers getting a ton of traffic from, you know, from Facebook mainly, but also Twitter, other platforms, and we wanted to be really careful. So we actually curated a lot of content on social and sent traffic other places because we wanted to get a sense of, you know, where this world was going and what consumption habits looked like on other platforms. And honestly, we could have created a lot more traffic, created, probably grown the brand more by being more aggressive, but we wanted to be smart. We also had, you know, a lot of irons in the fire. We wanted to make sure and get our app right. We didn't want to screw that up. And I think that is a pretty common mistake a lot of publishers make is they just try and do it all, and they think like, okay, we're gonna do this on social, and we're gonna, you know, also get people to, you know, subscribe to this, and like it's just a lot, and without a big team, it can be really exhausting. So and even then, it can be exhausting. You don't want the brand to come across as schizophrenic to people. So, you know, we were pretty careful about that, and so it's not something I look back on with any kind of regret, because I think if anything, we, you know, yeah, we were like a lot of publishers who saw traffic, you know, go way up and then crash down as far as what, you know, what social, like Facebook in particular, was sending to the websites. Like that wasn't a huge concern for us, because we were viewing social as an opportunity to grow brand, not exclusively audience. So, you know, it wasn't like we had to then figure out what to do with the business. Like when we lost this traffic, we were in a good spot, because we were never over reliant on it to begin with. So, I think credit to Turner for like just being really supportive of BR blazing its own trail and supporting us, you know, financially, but also with, you know, additional investment dollars, but also kind of, you know, being right there and saying, hey, like, you know, Turner's a TV company, and TV companies are going through different challenges. And, you know, they're saying, hey, like, we want Bleach Report. We want some of our other bets to really figure some of these things out for us to make sure the, you know, sustainability of the larger Turner umbrella is in a really good spot. So, I think it's been, I think that's, we've been really lucky to be in that spot, needless to say. So there's not one thing that really jumps out as like, oh man, like, why did we do that or why didn't we do that? I think mainly because, like, you just got to be realistic at some point that you just can't do it all. But I think for us, the decisions we have made and the bets we've made have been at the best interests of sports fans. I really do believe that. We think, like, okay, like, what are we going to do to make the experience of being a sports fan, you know, better, easier, more fun for people? And that has been at the root of a lot of our decisions, if not all of them, and definitely our best decisions.
So when I'm kind of out and about talking to people about the industry and you guys come up, people, they're kind of impressed with how you guys have grown and how you guys have kind of, you know, adapted to new platforms. And one of the things I say when people kind of ask me, you know, how is Bleacher Report doing this, is I think a lot of it, in my opinion, and you can correct me here if I'm wrong, is basically the company culture. You know, you guys had four founders who were all friends from the same high school. It was basically the city that, you know, borders where you and me grew up from. And, you know, a lot of those founders stay involved until the end. You guys have kind of been a little bit more nimble. I think your kind of management team skews a bit younger. You guys have done kind of some interesting moves in terms of Snapchat and Instagram and acquiring House of Highlights, kind of a bit irreverent in terms of how you approach things, maybe not kind of cozying up to the old school way of thinking. How would you kind of define the Bleacher Report management culture, and how important has that been to where you guys are today?
It's definitely important. I mean, I think it was really eye-opening for me when I started the company that, like, you know, I mean, it's easier with a company of 15 people or whatever, that if you have an idea, you can, you know, you got to lay it out and how you want to go about it, but you can do it and you can actually see the results right then and there. And it's pretty rewarding. And, you know, I think as Bleach Report has grown, and I think as a lot of companies grow, especially companies that go through an acquisition, it's very easy for layers of bureaucracy and, you know, you kind of to enter the fray and you kind of get in your own way. And look, I'm sure there's some things we could have done more efficiently over the years, like without a doubt, but I think it has been really great to see people come in at all different levels of the company and have big impact, because they've got ideas and they see Bleach Report as a, you know, a way to make them bigger. And you know, they see kind of fires that we've lit, and they want to pour gasoline on them to you know, make these things as big as possible. So, you know, I think that's a mentality we really do stress, and, you know, we don't just, you know, say it in company-wide messaging in all hands meeting. We like honestly ask our other leaders, you know, like established and new to go impress that upon their team. So, you know, because of that, we've seen great ideas and great things come from all different parts of the company, all different job titles, all different ages. Like you mentioned, House of Highlights and Omar, who, you know, started talking with us, and credit to Doug Bernstein on my team, who really discovered Omar and saw the potential in House of Highlights. And, you know, that was years ago, and Omar is now how old? He's 22, 23. And he's someone that's literally with us shaping the sports landscape. And I think, you know, there's a lot more people. Well, I don't know if there's anyone exactly like Omar, actually. He's pretty awesome. But there's a lot of other people with great ideas at Bleacher Report and maybe at other places that we certainly want to listen to them and figure out how to work with them.
All right. I have three hypotheticals I'm going to ask you. And on a scale of 1 to 10, tell me how likely you think it is. So the first one is, opposed to a year ago, about a year ago, they said 4% of people were subscribing to news products. And over the last year, that number has jumped to 18%. And within our industry, people are now paying for The Athletic, who today their CEO had some comments. They said, if you get your sports from Bleacher Report, those are empty calories. So on a scale of 1 to 10, what is the chances, 10 being most likely, 1 being least likely, that down the road, Bleacher Report could potentially have a subscription service for maybe more long-form content that I think you guys right now put on BR Mag? How likely would you say that is?
I don't know. I mean, it's definitely something we've talked about, put it that way. So the idea is not out of left field. And I'm not saying that, like, that means subscription is imminent, like, at all, but I think it's more come up in the context of the quality of the journalism that we're creating through BR Mag and how well it's resonated with folks. So, you know, I think, you know, for us, it's I think, you know, especially amidst the kind of like infamous quote-unquote pivot to video that a lot of media companies are going through, which is fine. And look, Bleacher Report creates a lot of video too, but I think it's really important, whether it's video, it's text, the combination of the two, that you've got really good journalism and really good storytelling at the heart of what you do. And, you know, that's what BR Mag has been for us. And, you know, so, you know, we'll see what we end up wanting to do with that. But it is going to be an emphasis for the company going forward. I think it has to be for Bleacher Report to be, you know, a powerhouse in not just sports, but again, going back to kind of being worthy of consumers' time, knowing that they have a lot of options out there. But, like, I don't know, I'm like, I hope a lot of these subscription services are successful. I think it's great, you know, whether it's The Athletic or a lot of the other things that are kind of popping up out there. It's like, it's great. It's like, it's good for the business for there to be options for consumers. It keeps everyone honest and keeps everyone putting their best foot forward, which is, I think, only good news for an industry. Look, because of sports and because so much of sports is, you know, tied to that traditional TV ecosystem, I think it's good when there's disruption and there's new things, and we kind of see what resonates with folks and what doesn't.
So I'm going to say that was about a 6. Would you say that's kind of the ballpark of likeliness that you guys could potentially get down that road?
I think what I'm saying is no comment, but I was trying to be nice about it.
All right. Well, I'll probably tee up 2 more no comments for you.
Great.
But do you think Bleacher Report could ever become the umbrella brand for Turner Sports? Like, what's the next frontier for the Bleacher Report brand?
Let's see. This another long no comment headed your way. I will say, like, you know, I don't know about that, but I mean, I will say that mentality though is not saying you're renaming everything BR, but I think what Turner leadership sees as the ceiling of BR is definitely like that high. Like that's the aspiration I think people view. Credit to David Levy, to Lenny Daniels, to Matt Hong, to the people within Craig Berry, like the people within Turner who have just been like so supportive of our business and want the BR brand to get so big. Like that is never going to be seen as an exercise in cannibalization. Like that's not possible. Like the BR brand cannot get too big in those folks' eyes, and they have helped us, you know, get as big as we are now. And, you know, and obviously the team here has done a lot of work to fulfill those expectations. But so I'm not saying they're going to like go renaming everything BR, but I mean, BR is a powerhouse brand when it comes to sports, when it comes to young people. And, you know, I think we'd be silly to not get that as big as we possibly can.
So the third potential no comment I have for you is, you know, you and me stay in touch primarily through our fantasy football league. And if you look at all the areas that Bleacher Report operates in, the one kind of area where it doesn't seem to have that same kind of ambition to conquest is in terms of, like, having their own fantasy games, like a Yahoo, a ESPN, a CBS. And if you look at the Turner, you know, rights that Turner has in terms of, like, March Madness, where you could do a bracket tournament, and I think you guys do some type of bracket tournament, but, you know, with the NBA, with basketball and baseball, it kind of seems odd that Bleacher Report has never really kind of gone after, you know, carving out some market share in fantasy sports. Do you think at some point Bleacher Report will kind of get in that game, whether it's traditional fantasy or daily fantasy?
I think, you know, you never say never, but, you know, I will say I think we're much stronger in creating compelling fantasy content that's built for the existing social distribution options than trying to create a whole nother game ourselves right now. We definitely tested some things out in the past, but like, man, that is like the problem with creating games at this point is it goes against how we all behave on the internet, right? We all want to use the platforms that we're used to. Like what are those, there's some stat out there like that, you know, 80% of people's time is spent within a handful of apps that they've downloaded. And like, guess what? Like one of those apps are like Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter for a lot of sports fans, the Bleacher Report app, which is great. But, you know, are we really going to try and create something new to try and break through? Or should we just make what we have drastically more compelling and keep making it better? I think the latter does our users and our audience better justice, and I think we want to deliver the best experiences possible. And if you're trying to create too many, you know, kind of you could fall in the trap of doing a bunch of things, being good at a bunch of things versus being great and best at class at a couple of things. So, you know, for us, that's really social voice and turning those insights that we learn through social into future content and business decisions versus, you know, trying to create something brand new that, you know, I mean, let's face it, it's just a tough sell through the social model to get people to download an entirely new app or to play an entirely new game when that's just not how people behave.
So I have one more kind of, job-specific question and then a couple casual, more friendly ones. And, you know, we're getting towards the end of the year, and I'd be curious if you had any kind of predictions for 2018 in terms of sports media. What could we see more of? You know, are there any brands you're watching? Is ESPN going to continue to lose subscribers? Like, what are the kind of things that you're looking at and have some thoughts on in terms of just the general space that we operate in?
Yeah, I mean, if you had a couple things. I think, one, I predict Bleacher Report is going to have its best year ever. Can't wait for that. two, I think, like, there's been a lot of conversation around soccer, especially with the U.S. men's team not making the World Cup. We've seen soccer grow dramatically for a long time at BR, and that's internationally and domestically. And I'm not necessarily talking about MLS in the U.S. I'm talking about, you know, European soccer, whether that be, you know, EPL or kind of, you know, bigger Champions League matches, which is the latter's exciting for that Turner's locked up those rights that go into effect next year, and Bleacher Report's a big part of that deal. But I do think soccer is, through FIFA, the video game in many ways. It's the game of choice in dorm rooms across the country, and especially with even younger kids too, where, you know, you play those games, you get really good at knowing the players, the tactics, the kits, the rivalries, everything there is around the sport. So I do think soccer, you know, despite the kind of like, oh my gosh, the U.S. isn't in the World Cup kind of doom and gloom narrative that's out there right now, it's going to be a massive year for soccer on Bleacher Report and, you know, hopefully for other companies that realize what the opportunity is there. So I think that's one. And look, I mean, I don't have any like prediction here, but I do think, like, you know, I'm interested in all the stuff that everyone's interested in, where you've got a lot of things shifting right now, where you've got this kind of TV model that, you know, people are questioning, and you've got a whole generation of people that, you know, we're not even talking about people who cut the cord, people that like are never paying for television, never paying for cable TV to begin with. And what's that going to mean when it comes to, you know, the next year, when it comes to future negotiations and distribution challenges that various companies are going to have? It's, you know, it's a really crazy time, and it's super exciting and fun to be at the heart of it and to see how all this stuff is changing. But it'll be an interesting year, because it's a big sports year. I mean, with you've got Olympics, you're going to have, you know, just another crazy NBA off season, where there will be a lot of hype going into that. Got World Cup. There's just a lot going on this year. So considering 2017 was supposed to be a quote unquote slow year, and then, you know, like August was supposed to be the slow month, and then you had the whole Kyrie Irving like stuff going on, and there, you know, it was a lot. So I think we're seeing that, like, some sports more than others, but, you know, it's a year round conversation. So 2018 in particular, when it comes to industry trends, but also just, you know, the number of national stories that will be related to sports will be at an all time high. So it'll be really interesting to see how those things connect.
So, Rory, this is going to be a tough one, and I'd be remiss as a journalist if I didn't ask you about 2003. And, you know, I don't know if you've disclosed this to your coworkers at Bleacher Report, but in 2003, you became the commissioner of our fantasy football league. And that is the one lost year in our league history where we didn't crown a winner. And I'm curious if we could jump back into something that happened 14 years ago. What happened? What are your thoughts? What went wrong? Is this something that you've disclosed to all of the employees at Bleacher Report? The commissionership of 2003.
It was just like one of those classic storybook tales where guy becomes commissioner of his high school fantasy team. You know, everyone's in college now. You're trying to do a draft over, like, I think at the time, AOL Instant Messenger, very complicated. He's getting very frustrated with his peers because no one's really making the picks they're supposed to. They're going out of order. He has sense of it. No one paid the league dues, and he was really upset about that he wasn't being shown the respect of previous commissioners. And then, you know, he, like, starts, you know, dating this girl in college that he's pretty into, and, you know what, sometimes you got to make decisions and you put your foot down and say, you know what, I'm going to put my effort into dating this woman who, you know, is now my wife and the mother of my child. We've been happily married for 7 years. And, you know, the league, they were pretty mad that things fell apart that year, but I think everyone understood they were part of the problem. And we've gone past it at this point.
That's a good answer. I'm glad we have closure to that. I don't know if all of the members of our league will accept it, but I'm relieved that we can now bring that to an end. All right, final question. And I'd be curious, you know, you grew up in the, you know, kind of Bay Area, and then, you know, spent your college years at USF and then went to work on the peninsula and back up to San Francisco, and now you've been in New York for 2 or 3 years. How do you like New York? Do you feel you're going to be a New Yorker for life? You know, you're at that phase where you have, I think, Decker's 2 or 3 now. You know, you have a great job, but, you know, let's say you were going to kind of, you know, decide to have a larger family or take another job or retire. Do you feel like you're a East Coast New York guy, or are you still kind of acclimating yourself to, you know, living there?
Man, I don't know if retiring's in the cards for me yet at the ripe old age of 34, but you never know. Yeah, we like New York a lot. New York's great. The Bay Area's great too. I grew up in the Bay Area, Mountain View, and went to school in San Francisco. Lived there for quite a while after. Obviously, think fondly of the early Bleacher Report days. It's great that BR has. We've got so many people in New York and San Francisco at this point, because we really were. You know, I mean, there's not a lot of media companies, honestly, that are, like, based in San Francisco. There's some, but, you know, it was interesting to grow a media company out there. And I think we kind of were able to take, and, I mean, credit to Dave, the other founders, kind of take what we really liked of startup culture and apply it to a media company. And then now that we've got this big presence in New York, we get to take advantage of all the things New York has to offer. I mean, look, a lot of other media companies, the leagues, other, you know, ad agencies, other folks are obviously based in New York, along with a lot of, you know, the creative industry in general. So, it's kind of the best of both worlds. So, you know, for me, I, you know, get to live in New York and I get to fly back and experience that in San Francisco and see family and all that who are out there still. So very, very happy with New York, but, you know, we'll see. What the future holds.
All right, and I think I said that was the last final one, but I'd be curious, of our fantasy football league, who do you think will actually listen to this podcast?
I think you'll listen to it, and
no one else.
I mean, you're obviously going to like send this to the group email chain, and then someone
No promotion. I will post it on my Facebook feed. Although we're not friends, I'm a little disheveled that you're on Facebook and we're not friends. I will admit, but I'll probably post it there. But I will not email it to the league.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll see. So, yeah, this is fun.
I would go. I'm going to go. Meeker and Taylor. We'll listen to this. Maybe Drew. I think Joe still has a palm pretty. I don't think Janai, Dan, Paul, or Ross are in question here. So Meeker, Taylor, and Drew are my guesses.
All right. Well, we'll see who's a devoted listener and who isn't, I guess.
All right. Well, hopefully your parents will at least listen, and my parents will. So we'll have, you know, between them about 4 listeners.
Yeah. Some of Mountain View, California's most influential residents.
All right. Well, hey, I appreciate the time. Rory told me a while ago, I will, if you should do a podcast. If you do, I will come on. So this is our 4th one. Brent Musburger, Kirk Herbstreit, Casey Stern. And now, Rory, we go back way back when, and we avoided to embarrass each other because we certainly have quite a bit of stories about each other. So I imagine that was probably going to be a mutually assured destruction to go through some of those stories. But glad we survived. Appreciate your time. Thanks for coming on, Rory.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
Our thanks to the president of Bleacher Report, Rory Brown, for his time today. Also thanks to Ben Koo for his assistance in conducting that interview. And thanks to Andrew Buchholz and Joe Lucia for joining me on the roundtable this week. That'll do it for episode 4 of the Awful Announcing Podcast. Check back in a couple weeks when we will be back for episode 5. Until then, please continue to keep it to awfulannouncing.com and follow everybody on Twitter as well. My name is Ben Heisler. We'll talk to you again soon.